Hi, this is Bill Nemitz, and welcome to another edition of Born to Run, our podcast with gubernatorial candidates running in this June's primary election. The purpose of this is not to talk about politics, not to talk about policy, but rather to focus on the life stories of the candidates and find out things about them that many voters might not know as they go to the polls on June 12th. With us today is Republican gubernatorial candidate Garrett Mason. Welcome, Garrett.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you.
I like the title of your podcast.
Sorry?
I like the title of your podcast.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, we're waiting for Bruce Springsteen's lawyers to call us, but yeah. we'll be in and out before they can catch up with us.
Okay.
So it's interesting, as I was preparing for this and looking at all the candidates, I thought, well, for some of them, asking them to tell their life story is a big challenge,
yeah,
given their point in their life that they're at right now.
Right.
You, on the other hand, I think you're probably the youngest candidate.
I am.
Correct? 31?
I'm 32. 32. I'll be 33 in a month.
Okay. So mm-hmm. You are coming at it from the other end. But you nevertheless do have a life to talk about.
I do.
So tell us, you were born in Lewiston, but grew up in Lisbon Falls,
that's
correct?
That's right. I grew up in Lisbon Falls. My family's been in the area for about 200 years.
Yeah, I saw seven generations.
Seven generations.
How do you even do that?
You know, we've.
How do you trace that back?
I've enjoyed a lot of family history, and my mom's father's family are crafts. And if you drive through Lisbon, you'll see Crafts Self Storage. You'll see Crafts Cars. We've just been in the community for a long time, and you can trace it all the way back to 1611 in Lincolnshire, England. A man named Griffin Crafts and his wife Alice came across the sea to seek a life in the New World. And there's a bunch of books written down in Harvard. And
did they come right here to what is now Maine?
They came first through Massachusetts, obviously, and they ended up in York. And then slowly migrated their way up. I think it was my seven great-grandfather, Samuel Crafts, fought under George Washington in the Revolution, and he was given a land grant up in Hebron. And he's buried there today.
How about that?
Yeah.
So you don't have to take one of these DNA kits. You've got.
I did.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did. And it was
no surprises.
No surprises. No surprises. But the other side of my mom's family, they were from Italy, and they came through Ellis Island, and worked in the shoe mills in Auburn.
Oh. Okay.
And have been here for about 100 years.
So you were born into a family with very deep roots.
Yeah.
Here in Maine. And as I said, you were raised in Lisbon Falls.
Yes.
Correct?
Moxie Capital.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah. You know,
in fact, I understand your mom, who, with condolences, you lost recently, was a huge Moxie Festival.
She planned
person.
It for many years.
She planned it.
Yeah, she did. And in fact, the committee and the town this year named it the Gina Mason Moxie Festival Parade.
So really?
It's named in her honor for all time and eternity, I guess.
That's great.
But my mom was a huge influence in our town. And we wrote this in her obituary, but she always wished that Lisbon had a mayor because she wanted to run to be Lisbon's mayor. She loved our town. And that showed in everything that she did.
Yeah.
But second weekend in July, man, come out,
30,000 people. So do you drink Moxie?
I love Moxie.
You love it. See, now it's one of those things you love it.
I love Moxie. You know? My grandfather, he used to...
I use it to remove rust.
Well, people don't know this, but in the 1920s, right before the Depression really took hold, Moxie was the number one selling soft drink in America. It beat Coke.
Wow.
And it's distinctively different, obviously. And we have you've probably talked to Frank Anicetti before, who mm-hmm. actually passed away last year. And Frank was the Moxie man. And he had all kinds of different stories about Moxie and how to drink it. People don't realize this, but you can put half a glass of milk and half a glass of Moxie, and it tastes just like a milkshake. So it's pretty good. Yeah. I'm telling you,
I'll
you should try
it. I'll take your word for that. So as a young kid in Lisbon Falls, you were born into a deeply religious family.
Yes.
Baptist?
Yes.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And your dad, if I recall, worked at first as a heating oil?
Yeah.
He
delivered oil. And yeah. I remember going out with him when I was really little, and he'd deliver oil to people's houses really, really early in the morning. And he, my dad is the quintessential American story. You know, he started there. He learned excavation from a couple of guys in town, and ended up buying, risked it all and bought his own bulldozer.
Hmm.
And he eventually started his own excavation business, which him and I still run today.
Oh, you're still doing
yep.
it?
Okay. He started out in golf courses. He did some work at Sugarloaf. He did some work some other places around Natanis. And then he just got into houses. And, I mean, he built what he has from nothing.
Hmm.
And I just, my dad is a very hard worker. And I'm really proud of him.
Oh, that's good. And your mother was a homemaker slash festival organizer
yeah.
slash right. and held a lot of local elected positions,
she
correct?
She did. Yep. My mom had a very successful career before she had me and my sister. And she worked for the Weather Vane stores. Probably a lot mm-hmm. of ladies remember that
sure.
store. And she managed the Weather Vane for a bunch of stores up in the Northeast. And then when she had me, she stayed home. And my dad tells a story, and I didn't know this until after my mom passed away, but when it came time for my mom's maternity leave to be over and she was getting ready for work, she just broke down in tears. She goes, I can't leave him. And so she never actually went back.
Really?
But she, you know, my mom was there for everything. She was, you know, every field trip. In fact, she was a chaperone on one of my senior trips. Yeah, my senior trip from high school.
That's a lot of
like,
fun.
You know, but she was the one that was taking us out at, you know, 1 a.m. to Times Square in New York City.
Yeah.
She was the one that, you know, would always kind of bend the rules a little bit. But mm-hmm. she was on the town council, the inaugural town council in Lisbon in 2006 when we went from a town meeting to a town council. And then, you know, I ran for the legislature in 2010, got elected to the Senate. And she couldn't stay away.
So she became a state rep.
She did. She became.
And I read that when even as you got into Senate leadership, I think this was in her obituary.
Yeah.
That every day in Augusta before she started her day at the other end of the Capitol, she would make sure to come by your office and give you a hug.
Every single day.
What was that like?
Well, it was. You know, there's been some other mother.
At some
son.
Point, you want to say ma.
Yeah. You know? But you know, she loved the process, and she loved. She would come up there even before, you know, she was elected and just come for the day with me just to see what it was like. And so people knew her.
Mm-hmm.
People knew who she was up there. And then when she got elected herself, she just, I still to this day, and I suppose I'll know someday when I see her again, but I mean, my mom was a mom. She loved her kids and she just wanted to be with us as much as she possibly could. And I sometimes wonder if she didn't run just so that she could be up there with me.
Yeah, keep an eye on you.
But she, you know, she would start every day, and I would come in like a bat out of hell every single day. You know, just being in leadership, it's that way.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd always be sitting there with someone, and it was always someone different, mm-hmm. just chatting them up. And mm-hmm. and I'd be like, Ma, come in. So she'd walk down there with me, and she goes, I just came in to give you a hug. I know you're busy. And she'd give me a hug, and then she'd just watch me. And I think that's just the way that, you know, moms are. They just
yeah.
watch their kids.
Oh, sure.
They
sure.
want to see them
yeah.
successful and happy.
And it's her realm, too, because she was involved in local politics.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't completely new. Do you mind if I ask what happened? You lost her in September.
Yeah.
And explain.
Yeah.
It
was very unexpected. I live next door. My house mm-hmm. is next door to them. We live on about 150 acres in Lisbon. And so my dad and mom gave me a piece of land for my graduation present when I graduated from college. And I have a house there. And I was practicing my speech all day long because it was the day before my announcement for governor.
Right. I remember it was all – in fact, that was postponed.
It was for three weeks. And she texted me and she said, stop practicing your speech. You're going to ruin it. And she goes, come on over and help me cook supper. So I went over and I was cutting up stuff for a salad. And I was telling her something that had happened to me that day. I don't remember what it was.
Yeah.
And we were laughing and talking. And she was getting ready to go grill some chicken outside. And she stopped talking to me. And I looked over and she had her hands on the counter just like she was reading a recipe or something. And I said, Ma. Because, you know, good Italian family.
We sure.
kind of talk loud with our hands and aggressively at some point, and she just looked at me, fell into my arms, and she died.
Oh my goodness!
And we didn't know, we didn't know what was wrong with her. But by the time I caught her, I knew she was gone.
Hmm.
And
was it a heart type of?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. We think it was a heart condition. My grandfather died very similarly, around the same age.
What a shock!
Oh yeah,
my goodness.
It was, I, and you know, she was my mom, so it's, I know what I lost.
Yeah.
But I think what struck me and my family the most was how much she was loved by the town.
Mm-hmm.
And that funeral was, Fortin Funeral Home told us, was one of the largest funerals that they've ever done in 70 years.
Wow.
And I think for us as a family, it was just what an impact she made.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really there. I didn't know if I wanted, after this happened, you know, as you said, I come from a deeply religious family and background, and I asked God heavily. I was like, is this something that you want me to do? And somebody just came up to me a week after the funeral and just said, so you're getting ready to run again? And it just kind of hit me. It was just like, of course. And she had her computer out next to the stove, sending out Facebook invites for my announcement.
To the announcement.
And I know what my mom wanted.
Sure. Well, if that, I was just going to say that. If you factor that in,
yeah,
it would be kind of a no-brainer.
She would have been
keep going.
Livid if yeah. I didn't. So, yeah. We got back on the horse 3 weeks later. And, you know, something like that, when that happens, it really puts a lot of life into perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know when your next breath, if your next breath's going to be your last. And that was an enduring lesson that I've carried with me since that time.
I suspect you grew up a lot in that couple of weeks in terms of just,
yeah,
your, like you said, your whole perspective on life and what's
yeah.
important and what isn't.
Dad, you know, my dad did too.
Yeah. And he's still next door to you now?
Oh, yeah.
So you're keeping an eye on him?
Oh, huh? We're keeping yeah. an eye on him. And he ran for the legislature. You know, he ran for my mom's seat, which was crazy. I never thought he'd do that, but he's doing great, loving it. But yeah, you do. You grow up. I don't care how old you are, when you lose your mom, it's hard.
Yeah.
And I had somebody recently.
Especially when it's so sudden and you don't have any time to prepare for it.
Yeah. And I'm just thankful to God that I never had to see her in a nursing home. I never had to see her sick. But we all grew up. My sister, me, my dad, my fiance, we started to treasure a lot of the little mm-hmm. things a mm-hmm. lot more.
Yeah. You don't let things go by quite so easily.
No.
Well, let me back up a second, a little bit more about you. I first met you 8 years ago.
Yeah.
The first day you showed up in Augusta.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember this.
I was just as surprised as you were.
I picked a bunch of rookies
yeah.
and decided I was going to write about, you know, several of them on each side of the aisle, and you were one of them. And you did have that kind of dazed and confused look on your face. But I remember at the time, and you can elaborate on this, that you had an interesting background in that you had gotten involved in a lot of sports type business.
Yeah.
You had worked for the Sea Dogs here in Portland.
Yep.
And more recently with the hockey team, the Lewiston Maniacs.
Yeah.
Tell us about, how did that happen? How did you go from, you know, small town Lisbon to
big city Portland?
Yeah. Sports management, you know?
Well, I remember the day that it happened, actually. I was in college in Florida, in Pensacola, Florida, and
what school?
Pensacola Christian.
Okay.
And right on the panhandle of Florida. And I had originally gone to school to be a teacher. I wanted to be a kindergarten teacher. And I lasted about 1 year. I couldn't handle the parents. I loved the kids. Loved them.
It's like coaching Little League. Same
it was.
Problem. Yeah.
And that's why I think God has a sense of humor, because, you know, now I'm in charge of, you know, 17 Senate Republicans who are all parents. But in all seriousness, you know, I remember the day that I figured out I was a horrible athlete. My sister got every ounce of that gene. But that, wow, these teams need somebody to run them. It's not athletes who are out there selling tickets and advertising yep. and hot dogs and Sea Dog biscuits.
Yep.
There's people doing that. And so I got online. I remember that night just in my dorm room looking up stuff, and I found out the Sea Dogs had this program where they basically trained people in one of the best minor league environments in the
right,
world.
Right.
I mean, there was hundreds of people that applied to the Sea Dogs.
And this was like an internship type job?
It was, mm-hmm. yeah. And so I applied for this for 3 years, and I knew I had to graduate early. So I worked really hard to graduate early, and I finally got the one that I wanted. And I flew up my senior semester, interviewed by Chris Cameron and Jeff Iaquessa and mm-hmm. a lot of the guys who are still over there now.
Yeah.
And
was Charlie?
Charlie was there too. Charlie Eschbach was there. He didn't interview us, but he was there.
Right.
And they hired me, and it was just the most amazing thing. And I remember.
And what did you do? What were your responsibilities?
We did group sales. Chris let me in on a couple of public relations things, and I got my teeth cut working in Portland, and going to work every day at a baseball diamond is.
It kind of sets a tone, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was just the most awesome thing. Yeah. And I mean, they ran us ragged, but it was fun.
Yeah.
And I loved coming to work.
Was it a paid internship?
Yeah, that was the best part about it.
You're getting paid to do it. Who gets paid to do an internship? Yeah, right.
And so then after I left there, it was like, go work for the ticket office at the Red Sox, which is kind of the obligatory job offer at the end, or go do something else. And I ended up... applying at the Lewiston Maniacs, which they were kind of new at the time. They'd just come off a President's Cup championship, and they needed a public relations director, which is what I wanted to do. And they hired me. And I for 2 years did that. And then the Maniacs went through many major transition, and I ended up being the only front office employee there.
Well, wait a minute. You were general manager.
That's when I got it.
Oh, that's when you became – okay.
I thought that was what they called the only guy.
So I
ended up being the only person working there one summer. It was lonely.
Yeah.
An ice rink, a huge, massive ice rink in Lewiston. It got lonely. And then they said, well, you're doing the job anyway, so why don't you just become director of administration? So I did. And it was awesome. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was 23 years old, running all over North America, recruiting hockey players with the general manager. And it got into the hockey side as well, in addition to the business side.
Because the
Quebec League, we have contracts.
Yeah.
You know, we draft players.
Right.
And so I got to play on a really big level at a very young age.
Yeah.
And it was, oh man, I still miss it to this day. Mm.
So in the midst of all this, you suddenly become not only a candidate for the Maine Senate, you know, we're no board of selectmen, no school board, no state rep. I mean, man, you know, and just like that, you're there. What was it, your mom? Was she the catalyst that got you involved politically?
It was the government. I remember I was 24, and we had made some major decisions with the Maniacs to... you know, cut some prices. Hopefully we got it back on the concession end or the shop end. And they had passed LD 1495. You probably remember that one. It was last people's veto, I think, that was done. And one of the taxes was on hockey tickets.
Ah.
And I was asked, I was basically, when I called looking for some help, I was told, well, why can't you just, you know, send a bill to your season ticket holders for half of the year? Because hockey straddles 2 years. And that I felt... I couldn't believe what I was hearing. And it was probably a rash decision at the time, but I was like, I'm running.
Really?
Yeah, that was it.
Wow.
And
so you were, at the outset at least, a single issue candidate.
I kind of was. Yeah, yeah. And my cousin was in the legislature at the time for Lisbon, Dale Crafts. And I ran, and we beat an 18-year incumbent by 11% of the vote.
Yeah, I remember that.
And it was just 10,000 doors we knocked on in that race.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe I got there.
Yep.
In fact, we were the first race called on election night because we won Lisbon so big that it was easy to call it.
And you haven't looked back since.
No, I remember watching Cindy Williams call the race.
From Channel 6?
Yeah. And just say, interesting results coming out of Lisbon tonight.
Hmm.
And I'm looking at it. I'm like, holy crap, she's talking about me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, even now, 8 years later, even as a member of leadership, of course, we still have a citizen legislature, and you all need to have a day job.
Yeah.
What are you doing now?
Digging holes with my dad.
You are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we have a business to run, which I've run for years now. And whenever dad needs an extra guy on a piece of equipment or... I still cut all the checks and everything at the business.
How many employees work at the business?
We have five, and sometimes six if we can find a truck driver.
Sure. Otherwise, you drive it. Right?
No, Dad does.
Oh, okay.
Dad does.
Okay.
I have no interest in driving a dump truck.
Okay.
But I'll play with the big Tonka trucks.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, every boy's dream come true.
Get to drive a bulldozer. Play in the dirt.
Yeah, without a doubt. So I want to get back to one theme because one of the things that does distinguish you from a lot of the other candidates is your religious background. And there's been some observations, of course, that factors in politically to some extent too. And what strikes me about this is we see survey after survey saying that as a state and perhaps even as a nation, we are becoming less and less religious.
Yep.
People, that doesn't mean people don't believe in God or a higher
morality,
power,
yeah.
but their connection to an organized religion, by and large, has diminished over the years. So, what my question for you is, what is it about you or your life or your upbringing that creates that makes that such a central theme in your life? What sets you apart from that other typical person who may have started out in a religious environment, but over time has drifted away from it?
I think that, you know, growing up, all of my great uncles were pastors. You know, my family helped start a church in Lisbon that my uncle is the pastor of today. We actually cut the wood off of our land to build the church. It was always a central tenet in our lives. But I mean, there comes a point in your life, and I think everybody's life, that you have to decide, who am I? You know, what do I believe? Like, what are the things that I believe, whether it be from the Bible or another set of principles that somebody else might have in their life? And I had to make that decision. And I went to Christian school, went to Christian college, and, you know, Jesus became my Jesus, you know, not my parents, not my uncles, not my cousins. It, you know, Jesus became real to me. And, you know, people ask me like, well, you know, how can you separate that from politics? And it's like, well, you know, what I learned growing up was be kind to people, you know, meet them where they're at. You know, just those are the things that I learned from being a Christian my entire life. And those are tenets that everybody can accept. You know, I think in Augusta, there's a lot of people who have lost their way. And they think that being conservative means you have to be crass and you have to be mean and you have to, you know, no compromise and, you know, just as much red meat as you can throw out there. And I think that goes for both sides, by the way.
Yeah.
And that's just not how life works. That's not how politics work.
Well, I would say though, there must be times in Augusta when your patience and your tolerance
gets
a little strained, huh?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've lost my temper a few times. Yeah. But you know, I
how do you deal with that? If you lose your temper publicly, and you get back to a quiet place, given your deep religious faith, how do you deal with that? What do you say to yourself?
You apologize and move on. You know, it's saying I'm sorry or I lost my head. That's not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength. I mean, people, if that's the case, it must be really easy to say I'm sorry. It's not. It takes a lot of character and it takes knowing when you are wrong to be able to do that.
Especially saying you're sorry without conditions, without
That's
attaching.
Right.
I love it when people say, I'm sorry you were offended.
Yeah.
You know? What is that?
Yeah.
You know what
I mean? Yeah. But, you know, I just think that people keep asking me, you know, well, how are you going to differentiate your religion from your positions? I'm like, I'm not running to be your pastor. I'm running to be your governor. And that's played out in every vote I've ever made. So, I think if people have worries about that, they can just look at my voting record.
Sure. We kind of only have a little more time here, but you mentioned this earlier, and I want to just touch on it. You're getting married?
I am.
In the middle of all this? Are you out of your mind?
We figured that we didn't have enough to do.
Yeah, so I guess not. When are you getting married?
August 4th.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. She's from California.
And what's your fiance's name?
Her name is Rebecca. Uh-huh. We met through politics, and her and her family are from right outside San Francisco.
Okay.
So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
She's in
California.
I know.
Liberal bastion.
I know. She was one of the last remaining conservatives, so we airlifted her out.
Okay. So this is a rescue mission.
Huh? Right. No. She loves Maine. She never thought. It was a funny moment. We were having everything at the house, and you know, small intimate gathering of like 300, and she. She was watching my dad level out the backyard because we're having it in a tent. And, you know, we got the bulldozer there and dump truck pulling in extra fill and all this stuff. And I had come in from an event we were at, and I stood next to her on the back patio, and she's like, you know, growing up in California, I never thought I'd get married in Maine, number one. Number two, that it would involve dump trucks and bulldozers.
And bulldozers.
and we kind of got a good laugh out of that. And she's like, we're living Father of the Bride, that Steve mm-hmm. Martin movie. And I go, in many ways, we are.
Yeah. So yeah. Now, I assume she had an opportunity to meet your mother?
She did. Her and my mom were very, very close. Uh-huh. And they shared a really special relationship. In fact, after mom passed away, my dad and my sister gave me my mom's wedding ring and her engagement ring, and that's what I gave to her. So wonderful. She's got my mom's ring, and very special for us.
So your mom, will, in more ways than one, your mom will be there on that day.
She will be, and yeah. You know, it's special because, you know, we live on some family land, and we have a family cemetery there, and my mom is buried there. Our home means a lot to us, and I know my mom will be there. She hasn't abandoned me yet.
Yeah.
And so,
let me ask you, given the fact that she's buried there, mm-hmm. and given so much that's happening in your life right now with the gubernatorial race and of course, your impending wedding, I assume you must visit her grave from time to time if she's so nearby.
Yeah.
Given everything that's happened since you lost her, and that was mm-hmm. only, what, 10 months ago?
7 or 8 months ago, yeah.
You know, what goes on there? What do you say to her?
What
do you hear her saying to you?
If people saw me on a day-to-day basis, they'd probably think I was crazy because I talked to her all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'm a Christian. I know where she is. And I know that the Bible says that that we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. And that's my mom's part of that now. And so she sees what I do. And so it's nice that I know that she's seeing what's happening here and the race. And I just know how proud she was. In fact, right before I left to go see her that night to go have dinner with her and my dad, the last text message that she sent me was, "I'm so proud of you." Hmm. And I know that she's proud of me. Hmm. And when I talked to mom, we kind of had the relationship where we knew what each other was thinking and saying anyways. And everybody will tell you, if you ask around, this is the male version of Gina Mason. So I mean, my mom and I just, and that bond doesn't break through death. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I think that anybody who's lost a parent will tell you that they know they still feel their parent.
You can feel it. Yeah. You can feel the presence.
Yeah.
Well, I can think of no better note on which to end than
me
that.
Either.
I do want to thank you for coming in, Garrett.
Thank you.
It's been great chatting, and good luck going forward.
Thank you very much.
And this has been another edition of Born to Run. You can find this and the other gubernatorial podcasts at pressherald.com.